Okay, I suggest we start. We go to discuss the dynamic this morning. Kumar or
Ross?
Ross?
Yeah. Good morning, everyone. Excuse me. Today we'll be discussing agenda paper 4B, the asset profile. Agenda paper 4B discusses the asset profile and the role it plays within the VRM accounting model. The paper provides preliminary staff views and qualifying criteria and begin to illustrate how the dynamic nature of portfolios will impact the asset profile over time. This paper represents the first paper from the plan developed and agreed with the board during the December meeting. The staff would highlight that this paper provides preliminary views to assist the staff in developing the core model. The staff will provide a comprehensive review of the model before it is finalized. This will provide the board with an opportunity to view the impacts of preliminary views in totality and their interactions amongst each other. This review will be important as the core model is being developed and discussed in stages. Once the core model is developed and agreed with the board, we will then seek external feedback. The staff acknowledged the need to discuss performance. However, as per the plan, it was agreed to first define the scope of the model and then move on to performance. The staff are developing the core model on that basis. Finally, the staff would comment that the project aims to improve information provided regarding the impact of an entity's risk management can have on current and future economic resources. Perfectly reflecting risk and risk management in financial reporting is aspirational. As such, while the starting point is the scope of DRM, i.e. the risk management policies and procedures covering the banking book, the staff recognize the need for consistency of application and consistency within IFRS standards. Having said that, paragraphs 7 through 34 discuss the role of the asset profile within the DRM accounting model and provide staff views on qualifying criteria for both existing assets and future transactions. The staff views are summarized in paragraph 35. Staff acknowledge that providing qualifying criteria might create tension between reflecting and not governing risk management. However, the staff believes some criteria are required for the reasons stated in paragraph 10. In paragraphs 24 through 34, the staff proposed that highly probable forecast transactions, and to be very specific, highly probable fixed and highly probable floating rate transactions, in addition to firm commitments, can form part of the asset profile. The model should allow for the inclusion of both fixed and floating rate future transactions. Paragraphs 36 through 47 discuss whether the model should be applied on a portfolio basis, with the staff views summarized in paragraph 48. The staff would highlight that segregating existing assets and future transactions into separate portfolios could be useful when considering the highly probable requirements. However, if the entity is able to satisfy the qualifying criteria without segregation, the staff see no need to mandate separation. Paragraphs 49 through 70 discuss the interaction between designation of portfolios and the dynamic nature of such portfolios. To summarize the staff views discussed in these paragraphs, there must be consistency between the risk management objective and the definition, construction, and designation of those portfolios. Furthermore, if the entity must consider future transactions to meet the risk management objective, there must be consistency in the treatment of future and existing transactions. For the reasons stated in paragraphs 65 through 68, the staff view growth as unique, and thus consistency between growth and other future transactions is not required. Nevertheless, growth should be managed consistently with how the entity manages risk. Designation, definition, and construction of portfolios with the primary intent to achieve an accounting result inconsistent with the objective of the DRM accounting model is prohibited. Paragraphs 71 through 74 discuss situations when de-designations of item within the model should be required, in addition to a discussion regarding voluntary de-designation. Regarding voluntary de-designation, the staff views are similar to those within IFRS 9. Finally, documentation requirements are discussed in paragraphs 76 and 77. The staff would like to specifically highlight the expectation for consistency between the entity's risk management policies and procedures and the documentation for the DRM accounting model. As such, the staff would like to discuss the questions in the paper in the order presented. As such, to begin, question number one. Does the board agree with the staff view in paragraph 35, which describes the qualifying criteria for inclusion within the asset profile?
Thanks, Sus. First, I'd like to really commend the staff. I think it's a very good paper in terms of providing a structured way to read the proposal or at least the operationality of the DRM, and then to get to the proposal. I really like the way you are structuring the discussion of the project going forward. And bringing into steps, I think, facilitates my understanding. As for the question on the criteria, I think it's particularly important for us to have very good criteria to establish the right boundary to what we believe should be the asset profile, because this is the key aspect of the model to me. Which assets are going to be under the DRM accounting model? And I'm reinforcing the accounting model, because although the objective of the model we are developing is to faithfully represent DRM as best as it can, there are some aspects that through the qualifying criteria we understand will better represent in terms of providing consistency with IFRS 9 and providing some discipline in terms of accounting. So that's, I do agree with your proposal.
Yeah, I agree with the proposal as well. My questions were about, I didn't have a feeling for how tight these criteria were. Are people going to be able to use these criteria in a way that suits them? I'm not quite sure when I say suit them what the objective is. But I just wonder how restrictive the criteria are. On the face, they look restrictive, but then when I dig in, there's words like does not dominate. That's a judgment. This has to be managed portfolio basis, interest rate risk, management purpose. So we're referring back to things that sit with the management. So I just wondered if you could comment on how tight you think they are and how operational they are.
Fair question, Anne. Absolutely. When we are putting criteria and we are trying to say it will discipline, let's try and assess, are we getting there? Let me go through the criteria one. Amortized cost is a pretty defined, well understood, because we are borrowing from existing. So as you'll see, what we have tried to do is if we have existing criteria, we have tried to use those because they're better understood and guidelines. Does not dominate is also something we have used from current 9. So that is used in practice. So that is things. Yes, there is judgment. I think the judgment is there in future transactions, must be highly probable. So highly probable does involve a degree of judgment indeed, but it is, how shall I put it, compared to other things, it has a higher burden of proof on you to do that. And again, going back to what we have done is we have used existing, and this is highly probable, not only is there in 9, it comes way back from 39. Classified subsequent measured at amortized cost, again, is pretty defined. So from a judgment point, I think managed on a portfolio basis, that will come in, and that's something we are trying to do, and you have to document that as part of your risk management. So yes, there is judgment there, but we have tried to balance it between what is, I don't think we have introduced too much new elements in here which people cannot use or rely on existing requirements. As we go through, yes, some of these things we will need to test and how practicable they are. I think there could be some questions on this, especially on one of the things which we have introduced. Let me be must reserve that are classified subsequently measured at amortized cost to be consistent. That's new. That is a new, and that could create some challenges in practice, but I don't think that could create some judgment issues. Yes, that's the new. The criteria number D is a new criteria.
Sue?
Thank you for the paper. It was also helpful for me in terms of understanding the sort of first step in the detailed analysis of how the model might work. And I agree overall with the sort of direction that you're going in for this first step of identifying what might be in the sort of asset population. I think the real questions are going to come up when we see what it means for performance, but that's, we don't know that yet. But I agree with the scope, but just a couple of observations. So, and partly I think building on what Anne's just been saying. So when we did the discussion paper on the portfolio revaluation approach, where we got pushback from preparers was often if there were areas where there was some sort of disconnect that we'd created between the way risk management happened and what we were proposing in the accounting model. So I agree with the sort of logic that you've got here, but I think there's a couple of areas we'll just need to be thinking about, and maybe they're things to keep in mind for when we do the first round of outreach with people. And just a couple of those, I think, would be the fact that we're saying that something needs to be measured at amortized, needs to be measured at amortized cost, which means that it has to meet the criteria for solely payments of principal and interest and business model. I'm wondering, while I can see the logic for that scoping, I wonder whether we might have situations where, because we've got rid of bifurcation of financial assets in IFRS 9, that we may have situations where risk managers are looking at groups of cash flows on assets that may include some of the parts of assets that are measured overall at fair value because they've got some option feature or prepayment feature or something that causes them to flip to fair value measurement under IFRS 9, but the rest of the instrument might be pretty standard and they might be looking at the cash flows as part of their risk management. Well, we may create a disconnect between our scope and the risk management scope by focusing on things that are eligible for amortized costs. So that's one I think we need to think about. The other is excluding pipeline transactions. I can see why you've got there. But again, I think we were told in the past that some of these types of transactions are thought about in the risk management cash flow, so we just need to look at that one as well.
Yeah, just to, if I can respond there, just to clarify, I think to say we're excluding pipeline transactions is one way to describe it. I think we could also say we're just requiring the pipeline transactions to be highly probable.
Okay. Which, but that still may not gel entirely with risk management, so I think that's another one to look at. And the other one, I think that I'm a little bit, I don't disagree with, but I think we need to sort of realise that it is new, and it's one that you alluded to or mentioned, Kumar, as the new one. I don't think we've ever had a situation where we've told people they need to think not just about whether a transaction, so an economic event, is highly probable to occur or not, but to also predict what its accounting classification would be. And we might get a sort of, again, is a situation where the risk managers may be fairly confident that something economically is going to have to, going to occur, but then they're going to have to get an accounting view on what the accounting classification would be. And I don't know how difficult or otherwise that will be, and it's partly probably going to feed into the first point about how many assets might be in the banking book who might not qualify for SPPI. So there's a relationship between those things. So I'm not saying no, but I think there's a few things we need to think specifically about asking people for feedback on when we do the first round of outreach.
Can I just come in on a couple of things? Absolutely. I think D is something we need to understand better, how operational that will be. Absolutely, we will ask them. Remember, it also feeds back when we come into that. This is initial discussion and everything is, how do we manage the performance? Because if it does not end up being at amortized cost, then it does impact the asset profile, and then what do we do with it? So all of these can be tackled on both sides, either here or on the performance side, because they'll absolutely cognizant on the point you said on something that is considered to be managed for interest rate risk on as part of the banking book, but fails because of SPPI test. We have had this comment. We have been thinking about it. We will certainly consider them. First is, let's find out what is the size of this population. How much is, how big a problem is it? Because there are two elements to it. Even if I look at it, so let's consider what are the ones. You have alluded to the ones which I think are the ones we need to think about, let's say for prepayments, features or anything. But there is also a population in there which could be, for example, linked to equity or commodity. So I would very much question whether these are part of your interest rate risk anyway. Initial thoughts, even the regulators in the fundamental review of the trading book have clearly said these are not banking book, these are trading book assets. So even if I cut it, we need to think, because all of this will get pulled in for that.
I agree with you. The only thing that makes me hesitate slightly is because IFRS 9 focuses on, does a contractual term exist, and it doesn't sort of look at likelihood of exercise. You could have some option features which are not considered that relevant, if you like, from a risk management perspective.
Yes.
And it may still make sense to look at the main cash flows on the asset in with other standard
other things,
instruments.
Yes.
And I just don't know how much that happens.
Yeah, exactly.
And so I just think we need to think about it.
Absolutely. We will consider that. And obviously, in the other thing is, remember, there's no accounting mismatch in this case. So the mechanics will have to be slightly different from what we do for the normal, because those are amortized cost and derivatives. These are both at fair value already. But yes, we will certainly consider those.
Jen Chow.
Thank you, Hans. Thank you. First of all, I agree with the staff's proposal, but in the meantime, I have two observations. One is regard to the paragraph 35C. It mentions that future transactions must be highly probable. I agree with that, but because the future transactions, here we include both firm commitment as well as for future forecast transactions. But for my comments, basically based for the firm commitment, because those commitments have been firm, and there is binding agreement there, so whether we still need the notion of highly probable for those firm commitment, or simply just put firm commitment there. There is a slight difference between this notion and with the existing IFRS 9.
Let me see if I've understood the question, Jin Chow. You are asking that if I'm allowing firm commitments.
Yeah, I think do not need to
include highly probable forecast.
Because it has been firm and there is a binding
contract
agreement there. So the management are still to make adjustment whether it's highly probable or not, or simply because it's firm.
I think we will need highly probable forecast because not.
Yeah, forecast is no problem. I just say that for the firm commitment.
It's a firm commitment.
It has been firm, it's different from.
It is different from highly probable, so that's why in future transactions we define it as highly probable forecast transactions and firm commitments.
So, but you don't have that written in C.
No.
So in addition, there's firm commitments. Yes. Jing Chao's just asking you, are firm commitments definitely in? You don't have to prove the highly probable.
Absolutely.
And the second observation, same as Sue said, that with regard to the paragraph 35D, for those future transactions, they will be classified as subsequently measured at the amortized cost. I have similar observation with Sue. Yeah, thank you.
Absolutely. We'll bring that up because it will link up with performance as well, Jin Chow. We are aware that D is a new requirement.
Martin.
Yeah, and I also agree in principle with this, but isn't it a problem, as also Sue said, with the feedback which we had on our first approach, that if this does not reflect what happens in risk management, then it is difficult, because my understanding is that if we have the asset profile, then we have the target profile, and we compare the asset profile with the target profile, then kind of effectiveness test in a later stage. And I see it difficult if we restrict it, and then it does not really shows what happens in risk management, and then how we should compare it with the target profile, which is different, and maybe includes transactions which are not highly probable, includes transactions which maybe credit risk is dominating something. And therefore, I think it is key that we, as we said, in an early stage, testing that, because otherwise we're developing something which is not then practical, usable in situations. And second question is, regarding this credit risk, what does that mean, dominate? Is it kind of when a transaction becomes significant increase in credit risk, and then we have a kind of then does in risk management, is it then that they're taking that off? Or I don't think so, but if we restrict it, I understand why we have done it, because it is linked what we do in other situations, but is that really what happens in practice in risk management?
I'll get Ross to answer, but I would say I've seen credit portfolios in the things being taken out. They will take out a certain portion of it and not include it.
Yeah, that shouldn't have a huge impact to begin with.
It's already taken out, yes.
Well, and hopefully it's a very small percentage of your total portfolio, so it should be almost immaterial.
Hopefully, Hans, depending upon where you're looking.
Except you're in a certain region of the world.
To add to what Kumar said, it would be very common for an entity to
take it out.
Remove kind of credit risk from their modeling, with the understanding that if something is, let me be careful with my words here, if something is not going to pay interest, then there's no interest rate risk to manage. So it's something that is considered.
Obviously, we will test it, Martin. That's why we have an additional state.
Yep. Françoise.
I will very much echo what Martin and Sue have said, because any deviation, in fact, from the risk management practice, because all this is really managed on a portfolio basis and as a whole. When you start having the restrictions that come from an accounting standpoint, something that risk managers will not even consider. It has the risk of derailing, in fact, the model and not getting to a loss of relevance together with, in fact, a loss of operationality together. So I'm happy that you start on that basis, but with this very heavy caveat being there and having to be checked. On the other criteria that you suggest, I have no objection to start with highly probable has been the threshold, also to be tested, but I accept that as a starting point. And where credit risk is being taken, maybe the labeling will have to be worked on, but I understand that it is where it comes from and why you do that. So basically support, but a strong caveat, as Sue and Martin have said.
Mary.
I think overall support, wanted to make a few observations, suggestions for carrying it forward. One is, and this is where there may be some difference between, let's say, me and Francois, you know, in terms of the approaches. When we did the portfolio revaluation approach, I think the feedback we had is, this is the way, you know, my risk management works, and this is a parallel universe you're creating only for accounting purposes, and you know, and it's a whole system, and it will reflect some of the activities, but it will do it indirectly and in a way we don't look at things. I think this approach, what you're saying here, is start and identify the entity's risk management activities, and then we might have to trim some off the edges for, you know, with the criteria that you're identifying, but it's still fundamentally built on the entity's dynamic, on the entity's risk management system. And I think in that context, where that's our platform and that's our starting point, as long as the criteria don't become too incredibly narrow, you know, if we end up capturing only 10%, you know, we trim it down so much that we only capture 10%, then I question whether it's worth doing. But if we are, in effect, capturing the majority of it, I think we absolutely have to think about what disciplines we impose, not just to be mean, but to think about what's the comparable information that we'll get across entities. And, you know, I think when, for example, just before, when you were asked about why the credit risk not dominating, there was an explanation that goes back to how these things typically are managed. And that's, to me, the right basis for testing what the criteria are. So that's why I support this approach. But I am not, you know, I don't want us to lose sight of comparability in the desire to, you know, to line it more closely with risk management, as long as we're starting from that base and it's reasonable trimming, rather than why is it, you know, why is it worth it at this point. I think on the point that Sue raised about predicting the future classification and the types of instruments that are, you know, first guess likely to stress that, I noted in the paper that you said in phase two you're going to come back about fair value OCI.
Yes.
Because, you know, and if I think about things that when tested through the SPPI filter might not qualify for amortized cost. As you said before, Kumar, if they go into fair value P&L, there's not a mismatch, and if they I guess there still would be a mismatch because it's future versus current, but I think thinking about the fair value OCI will be quite important for that category. Then the last thing, and this is maybe in terms of thinking about our work plan and outreach, I think very good explanation about why we are, dare I say, recycling terms that we have used already in terms of hedge accounting, things like highly probable, does not dominate, etc. I don't know, because I don't know this business well enough, but I wouldn't be surprised if these become more important or affect a larger volume of transactions when we're in this setting than they do today. So I think a question that I'd ask you to think about is, can we get a handle on how these are applied in practice today under IAS 39 or IFRS 9 for the general hedge accounting model? So, you know, we say they've been around for a while, practice is established, et cetera, but making sure we understand what that practice is and that we don't have surprises ahead when we find out, you know, just how they're applied today so we can assess in practice whether they're the right test for these.
Absolutely. Can I just come in for 1 second?
Yeah.
Absolutely agree, Mary. We will do that. And one point which you make is important, and we should keep in mind that we are changing the population on which this thing will be applied. So we need to understand, we should be surprised. I just wanted to remind, we are absolutely cognizant that whenever we create a disconnect with risk management, what we're doing. But remember, these, when we did some of the things and we tried to look back to some of the things that are included in the asset profile and everything, they include properties, plants, because everything is considered to have that kind of risk, and logically so by the bank, because they are collateral, which they have got in loan, lieu of the loan, which is a 0% asset for them. So we will try and get it together, but from the initially when we started the project, we've always said that it will never be a perfect match, as you say, Mary. So that articulation which you gave, that we are trying to come up with a subset as close as possible based on risk management, I think is the objective which we are trying to go for. Absolutely.
Nick?
Thank you. Just a few comments on paragraph 35 to begin with. First of all, I mean, there will be some points in the cycle when credit risk is significant. It could be very significant. And equally, credit risk may well impact the projections of future transactions also at some point in the cycle. So there are some moving parts here. And then just on item E, I was a little uncomfortable with the wording here, and I just wonder whether we'd rather say items which are not already designated in a hedge accounting relationship end.
Okay.
We don't. I just found it slightly...
Don't need to go more.
Random way. And I guess, big picture, I'm trying to think about this. This is our foundation. This is our starting point for the model. And so intuitively, I think I probably am thinking about this in the right manner. I want this to be stable, but by its very nature, I don't think it is. And so perhaps it's better to think about it in terms of what's come up already in terms of being feasible from an operational perspective, but with the appropriate disciplines, rather than to think about something that's necessarily stable. But I'm sure we'll come on to that as we get to performance.
Yes, yeah. A lot of it, Nick.
Gary?
Thank you. By the way, Roscoe, very good paper here and very readable. Okay, thank you, Fernando. Similar to many of their comments, I'm on board with where we are. A few clarifying questions or comments on 35. I'll start with a comment that was made here, but it's not on 35, is how I agree. This all assumes a reasonable, rational risk management process and system or policies. At some point in this project, and it's not on your core few, we're going to have to define what are the characteristics of them, from very sophisticated to wishful thinking, you know, but there's going to be some risk management profiles that are not going to be acceptable for this, you know, if not speculation, they're closer to speculation than true risk management. So someplace we're going to have to come back with it. I don't know that it's critical to do early. We can work with it now, that it assumes it's going to be a valid, viable risk strategy, and we'll define that later on. I think on a lot of the comments I had were already been made, so I won't go back through all of them, but I do agree, future transactions, number D, I mean, you're anticipating that there'll be amortized cost, things change. And I do appreciate some time and performance. We're going to have to deal with those that are fair value through OCI, you know, comes. The thing that I would be a bit concerned with, we're using the word highly probable. Now, that's is defined in IFRS 9, I think, is what you're thinking. But that's just going online now, you know, and live in the world. But as you move through, and in the past, I had, you know, informalized, had trouble with highly probable transactions. And you're moving between anticipated, forecast, highly probable, pipeline. You're using a lot of words that arguably could be used interchangeably unless you're really close to the stuff. I would here on the only use highly probable and drop the other phrases because the layman will think they mean the same thing. And we don't mean the same thing. And one of your first comments, I asked, what's associated with the pipeline? I think he answered it, pipeline's fine as long as they're highly probable. And that's it.
No, we would drop it.
Yeah, just one comment. The concept of highly probable also exists in IAS 39 as well. So it's, yes, it is in 9, but it has been around for some time.
But this is a very different model. In the past, the models are all individual one-on-one linked and effectiveness tested and documentation. That's not where this is going to be going, you know, assuming we get through it. In that sense, highly probable on a portfolio basis is very different than highly probable on a one-on-one basis.
I would agree with that, yes.
Just one thing, Gary, absolutely agree about your risk management. Just okay, where we will cover that is when we come to the target profile, because that embodies this, and that will be a significant...
That's the next thing.
Next.
Doug. Thank you. I like this approach, and I appreciate. But just a question, what are we voting for? Because your proposal is very precise, like a drafting stage. So we are not voting for the tentative decision, but we are just voting for the direction you are moving ahead for testing if it works. So that is the confirmation. And as you wrote in the paragraph 10, this dynamic risk management approach is somehow deviation from the IFRS 9. So therefore, if we make some model, then for those who have a very similar model with our model, then it can be benefited. But those banks would be benefited. But for those who do not have those models, would not be benefited. So that is the difficulty of this project. So I think the global outreach is really important once we establish this model, because if the environment is different, if the jurisdiction is different, the business model, which is equivalent to the risk management model, could be significantly different. So I totally support to develop the model now, but do the significant global outreach.
Darrell.
So a lot of the things I would have said have been said already, I think. So just to echo some, to try to be additive to what's been said already. Firstly, I think the point, the clarification, Ross, that you made on pipeline versus highly probable is really important. I read it the way you read it, but I think there are some people who've read it otherwise, and I think that is a critical clarification that we're not throwing away pipeline. On the topic of fair value, profit and loss, I agree with where Sue and Martin were. I assume when we were talking about fair value, profit or loss in those circumstances, we were talking about the held to collect business model. So it was a failure of the SBPI test, not a failure of the business model test. And I've got some comfort in that space because I don't have to deal in that particular model with regular sales activity. Mm-hmm. So the sales activity comes out of it. It's not a complication to the process. Kumo, you mentioned that you would want to follow up on the regularity with which, how much of these assets there really are going to be under IFRS 9, and I think that's valid. I think there's a second thing we also need to follow up with is, once an asset has been classified as fair value, profit and loss, does that mean it's actually managed differently from a risk perspective? And I suspect that may be the case. They may think differently about those assets. I think we also need to consider that by highlighting the failure of the SPPI test, or by highlighting the failure that the fact that you haven't met the SPPI test, we may well be highlighting some particular transactions from both an internal perspective and from a regulator perspective, and the question may actually arise as to whether those should be in the banking book at all. So I think that's something else that we need to be aware of. On the fair value OCI, and I know you're coming back to that, I have slightly more reservations in that space. I accept that because that is shown in the income statement and an amortized cost method, it affects NIM and therefore it is going to be under consideration. But the moment we bring fair value OCI into play, we're going to have to consider how sales activity affects the model, and that adds a complication that we don't necessarily, we haven't necessarily thought about up until now. And then I think picking up on what both Mary and Gary were saying, but I think this is important. Picking up on the words dominant and highly probable from IFRS 9 is great because they are in use, they are words that people are thinking about. But they are typically used in the context of IFRS 9 when thinking about isolated types of circumstances, where you generally have a binary outcome. It either is or it isn't, no matter what the probability is that you're considering. As soon as you get into a portfolio type analysis, so for example, I could say that a 15% credit loss is dominates, but if I can reliably estimate that it's going to be 15%, that seems to be a slightly different outcome too. And I would think about that in any, so not to change anything, I agree with what you said out here, but I think as we move ahead with the project, we just need to think how some of these things scale up when you're thinking about portfolios instead of individual exposures.
Errol, I didn't understand what you, the last part of your argumentation about difference between portfolio approach.
So if I think about a single exposure with, let's say, a 15% probability of credit loss, so 15% probability it'll fail. On a single exposure, well, let's make it 10% to keep the maths easy. on a single exposure, that means in 1 in 10 circumstances, I will get nothing.
Yeah.
In 9 out of 10 circumstances, I'll get everything.
Yeah.
That means 1 out of 10 times my hedging strategy would fail. If I now think about a portfolio, and I say if I'm thinking about a portfolio across the board and I expect a big enough portfolio that I can reliably expect that 1 in 10 exposures will fail, I can then say that I have a hedge that takes into account the 90% that will not fail.
Yeah.
And that means my hedging strategy actually could work in those circumstances. Yeah. It's not absolute, and clearly there are complications, and Nick, you were talking about them because credit is not an absolute science. But it is just worth thinking as we scale it up.
Absolutely, Darryl. It also will happen with highly probable in cash flow because I've moved from individual to portfolio, as Gary also pointed out. The connotations change, so the layering, we will come to that, the layering, how do you do? You're effectively coming to, I don't want to get into, using the famous term bottom layer. That's what you're getting into.
Chair Wu.
Thank you. Just a clarification. The paper is very, very nice on explaining the first step of the asset profile. But just as a kind of a non-banking expert, I'm just, I don't know about the banking management, the banking accounting. So, but this terminology, growth, it's not easy. Could you explain this growth, the concept of growth in a more, you know, the not general people, stakeholders? In the paragraph 65, you describe one sentence what the growth means there.
We are in just up question one, Changwu. Are you coming to later?
Oh, sorry.
Yeah. Okay.
Oh, we are just talking about the
qualifying criteria.
All right. Okay. Later.
I'll wait for that. Okay. Everybody happy with one?
Everybody happy.
Okay. Let's move on to question two.
Question two. So, wonderfully worded question. Does the board agree with the staff view in paragraph 48? Paragraph 48 discusses.
Tell us a little more about paragraph 48.
Paragraph 48 discusses whether the model should be applied at a portfolio basis, and so we should be defining portfolios of assets, or whether it should be applied at the individual asset level. Staff view on that is that it should be on a portfolio basis for the reasons in those highlighted paragraphs.
So I think this possibly highlights to a certain extent the reservations about fair value OCI, or about fair value profit and loss, not about fair value OCI, because I think fair value OCI by definition becomes a different strategy and therefore a different
Not necessarily.
Portfolio. Not necessarily. Which then leads me to the second point, which is that we've had some stress in recent times with defining level of aggregation above the single contract. And so just a reservation that that may well come into play as we progress.
I don't think we've got any choice other than to do this on a portfolio basis. I think this is a bit of a trick question, given everything that you've told us about how the risk...
Would I do that?
..how the risk is managed. But I'm going to peek ahead a little bit to question three, because I think you definitely we have to do it on a portfolio basis if we're going to do this project. It doesn't really work otherwise, from what I understand. But I think also, from an operational perspective, it just wouldn't be manageable unless it's done on a portfolio basis, given just how dynamic these portfolios are. And when we start looking at question three and we start thinking about, you know, moving things from the future sort of transactions to the existing asset portfolios in the way that's suggested. I understand why you're doing that, but for me that opens up sort of whole open portfolio type thinking. And I just wonder how much individual tracking you have to do to know what's where at what time, given the splits between portfolios that we're... you're sort of envisaging. So I agree it needs to be a portfolio approach, and I just think we need to keep an eye on the way that we're doing the mechanics. Doesn't sort of undermine some of the benefits of that portfolio approach by bringing in needs for tracking to work out when things are moving between portfolios.
Everybody yes. Happy with question two?
Yes.
Okay. So, sorry. Move to question three?
Question three. Question three is even better worded. Do you agree with the staff using a number of paragraphs? So this entire section discusses kind of designation at a portfolio level and the interaction between designation and the dynamic nature. And so to summarize the views in here, as we said in the tee up here, we're saying that you should designate portfolios, and that designation should be consistent with your risk management policies and procedures, and you should apply that consistently over time. And that'll apply to both existing assets and to future transactions if you must consider future transactions. And so that's a consistency type of argument for designation, considering how that this is managed on a going concern basis. The one caveat to that, as we've talked about, is growth, and that growth is sometimes considered separately than the normal role for the reasons as described. So we think that while growth should be allowed to be designated as long as it can be deemed to be highly probable, that organizations may choose a different percentage to manage growth versus the existing assets and other future transactions. Just to briefly summarize the discussion in those paragraphs.
Mary.
Good. Just on that different proportion, this is just a very basic sanity test. If, let's say, an entity has determined that its strategy is hedging 80% for existing and future transactions, is it typical that they would select a lower proportion for growth on the basis that that has perhaps less certainty regarding timing? Is that kind of the typical pattern? Not a requirement, you're not proposing that, but is that one of the reasons why you're thinking about having different proportions here?
The main reason I'm thinking about different proportions, and we'll talk about this more when we talk about the target profile, is that if I think about growth, so originations above and excess of maturities, to answer Chung-Lu's question earlier, I have to fund the growth. So there must be a liability somewhere. There must be cash coming from somewhere. So if I'm going to hedge growth, which has not yet occurred, I'm assuming something about the funding profile. So I need to make sure that I'm making two assumptions at that point. So I can understand that can be a difficult thing to do, and so some entities will choose not to do it. So that's one reason why I think you could have a different percentage of growth than some of the other portfolios. To be very specific, if I have growth that's going to be funded by something that has not yet been priced, and growth in the asset that has not yet been priced, I have two items that have not yet been priced, and so there is no risk. There is no risk. There is no misalignment in pricing. And therefore, what am I hedging? So there are many people that will take that opinion regarding growth, but as we discussed in the paper, if I'm considering growth and kind of core funding, the considerations are different.
That growth must be highly probable, and based on your estimate of management for a long time. So So if sometime, maybe 5 years, the first growth estimate is different from the actual growth, then there is a change.
There will be a change, and these are the changes which we need to discuss when we discuss performance. Obviously, there's a change. Yeah. Same thing happens today, Chengu. You have a highly probable forecast transaction that you're hedging. It doesn't happen. What do we do? The accounting standards gives pretty specific guidance. What do you do if it's in a hedge relationship? That will all come through in performance.
So Absolutely. That part is related to dynamics of this one? So it's all kind of open.
It's an open portfolio. So that brings
so you
in
can
it.
Choose any kind of estimate on this growth. Not still that we have to qualify all this kind of a question one criteria. Yeah. But I'm just wondering the abuse possibility on this kind of thing. That's what I'm considering, you know, whether growth concept is seems to me still not clear to me, you know, how to calculate, measure this growth by the bank. So sometimes they can maybe make some kind of an optimistic estimate on the growth in some specific period, then they can manage for the first 3 years about the five-year time horizon. It's kind of possible.
Possible. That's why the filter of highly probable comes in, Chengu, which we use for any of the forecasts today. Banks can estimate growth. It's not that they cannot based on past performance. What we are saying is that you do estimate growth, but you cannot just make an estimate out of thin air. You have to back it up. What highly probable means that you have a higher burden of proof on you to put these numbers in the place. Anybody can, it's a judgment call, but we do have that today. Yes, it will get stretched more for growth. I appreciate that, but it is there. We have tried to put as much a filter. But having said this, if we take growth out of the portfolio, I think this is where it becomes a disconnect, which will be pretty big between risk management and what's happening for us to try and marry the two.
So that part is a kind of a hard spot for their maybe auditor and manager relationship, mm-hmm. whether auditor might not agree with your estimate, yeah. Then
we have that today, yes.
Errol.
I get myself slightly confused in the designation process, and I just want to clarify that I'm understanding it correctly. So there's essentially a two-stage designation process. The first stage is which assets and which future transactions. The second stage is the percentage, and the percentage then indicates the extent of hedging activities against that. Mm-hmm. And so it's that sort of two-stage part that I wanted to think about. And then I just wanted to ask whether in thinking about this percentage, whether there was a view, whether you've taken a view on the percentage potentially being a range, say 65% to 75%. And how that's dealt with, or is there assumption that there is an absolute percentage and anything outside of that specific percentage is outside of the process?
It's okay. Can I come understand a little bit? And I'm going through a little bit in my head what the range. Are you talking about like an effectiveness range using wrong words?
I'm
just the designation.
There may be a license given to the risk management department to manage between 70% and 75% of the exposure, of the designated asset exposure.
Okay.
Now there's a statement of fact, how much did they really hedge? And then there's a statement of how much were they allowed to hedge at the inception of the transaction.
We haven't considered a range, because I think the range of the thing which comes in can also get accommodated in the target profile in what you are trying to achieve for. The reason, and I get a bit skeptical about whether we can put a range on the asset profile, is because, remember, this is a dynamic portfolio now. And going forward, I have to create a measurement to come up with a delta between 2 points. So by very definition, if I have to create a delta, I have to fix 1 point. So the more allowance I give in the fixing of this point, the more difficult it becomes to measure that delta. The range of what is within your risk management, absolutely agree. Nobody does it to a fixed number. That will come up within the target profile. That's where we will discuss. And that will also very clearly have significant bearing on performance.
And I think that then probably talks to, I need to think about this actually as a three-stage process then, as opposed to just a two-stage.
You will have to come up with a target profile, because this is the asset profile which you are hedging, but what are you hedging to? Because that becomes very much, We don't do that in the normal hedge accounting, and that's a big deviation or the new bit in the model. Because as I told Gary, your risk management, whether it is trading or anything, I know these are loose words, but it's all what you are hedging to.
A few just thoughts, observations. So my understanding of risk management is that they look sort of at cash flows and whether it belongs to existing assets, future transactions or growth or whatever. It doesn't really matter so much. It's all about cash flows, projections. So I wasn't expecting us to land on a sort of split between things that related to existing assets, future transactions, growth because of that thing. Mm-hmm. Having said that, I can see the benefits for us from a discipline perspective of doing it that way because, for example, we can see whether highly probable transactions are actually occurring or not because they're being looked at separately. So I quite like that, but again, I'd be interested to hear feedback on whether people think it's operational because it's different to the way they think about it, as I understand the risk management process. So I like it, but I don't know whether they will. And then a couple of just observations, and I think you suffer the consequences of me having now worked on a few projects with open portfolio type things, and I understand all of the complexities that throws up. So I'm thinking impairment and insurance.
I suffer anyway.
Yeah. And so if I've got, say, an existing asset portfolio and I start off on day one with my assets on day one, I understand that initial designation is day one, but then future transactions turn into existing assets and so they get added into the portfolio. So I think we're going to have questions about what is the point of initial designation when I keep stuffing things in the portfolio, and also how long can the portfolio last for. Mm-hmm. So can I have a portfolio of assets that are, I don't know, five-year assets and I just keep adding to them forever, and that's just a portfolio that lives forever? I don't know. And does it matter? Because the other thing I don't know yet, and I'm presuming you guys have got a vision, and I don't need to know what the vision is today, but the thing I can't yet get my head around is, and to your point, you need an anchor to work out what the delta is. So nobody really liked our portfolio revaluation approach, so I'm not trying to sell it here, but one of the benefits of it to me was that it was asking people to do quite a direct measurement of the things being hedged for a particular risk. So you looked at what you had and you measured it.
Yep.
Whereas here, I think we're heading towards some sort of model where we look at our asset profile that we've chosen, mm-hmm. we look at the derivatives, and we look at our target, and we're sort of trying to say, did we achieve what we intended to achieve or not?
Yep.
And I can't yet picture what my base thing is that I'm doing the comparison with if it's a very open portfolio with lots of stuff flushing through it. I'm sure you've got a picture in your head, but for me, I can't yet envisage how we've got the stable base that Nick was referring to. Maybe the portfolio means it works, but I'm going to be coming back to ask you that question in the future because I don't really understand quite how that works just yet.
Okay. Just do it with one thing, we can clarify, so agree. What we have done... In the portfolio side, the only thing we are, as of now, saying mandating is that you can't have different currencies and prepayable and non-prepayable in the same portfolio. We are not saying if you can track and manage existing and growth together, go ahead. We are not saying you have to do it. But, as I said, indirectly, if I say highly probable and you have to have some idea of which, it doesn't have to be individual, and that rounds up to Daryl's point, is what is the layer and the cash flows that are moving out. We think it will be much easier if you have these three separate portfolios. But are we mandating and saying, Yuda? No, we are not. You can add it together as long as you can manage and tell me which transactions are, which were highly probable, and as Xianghu said, it doesn't happen, what are the consequences?
What I think will be interesting for us, both from a discipline and a comparability point, that Mary raised earlier, is I think we're going to have to be comfortable that by making different choices between how much slicing and dicing you do and how often you set up portfolios and things, is it going to have an effect on how the performance assessment comes out or not?
It will link up with that. And especially what you're talking about, the role of the portfolios, infinite life, growth, closing down. Yes.
Amaru.
Thanks, Seth. I think, apart from what has already been said, one particular aspect that I would like you to explore during the outreach that is yet to come
that we mentioned here many times, management strategy, and we do not expect change to occur frequently. We talk about the adjustment, rebalancing, and so I guess this, my expectation is that this strategy, management, DRM strategy, should be well documented,
yes,
and approved by the right level of people within the organization.
Yes.
And also how they would treat the potential for ranges in eventually, and how they would treat the growth and expected and highly probable transactions and things like that. So one thing that for me would be particularly interesting to know is how this is documented, how it's treated internally in terms of approval, and eventually how this all connects with business models in some way, what we think about when we had IFRS 9. So I think documentation, we don't talk much about documentation in the whole paper, but I think behind my mind is something that I have as a precondition to everything.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I struggled with the paragraph 60.
60?
Yeah, 60. And especially latter part, says, the staff view, the changes to designate portfolio resulting in updates of the asset profile should not represent a designation or de-designation event, but instead a continuation of existing relationship. And I think you are trying to give a kind of a high level principle of the designation and the resignation issues. So do you think it's these words with the terminology with the update and the continuation and the changes. So update is not change.
Okay.
As long as it's a continuation. So the continuation could be a keyword. So if that is the staff view. So just my...
No, fair point.
Mary?
Two questions. One is a point of clarification on this, and one is something that I think is probably for future consideration. The clarification question is, when determining the designated percentage of a portfolio, are you thinking that that percentage is tied to what the actual risk management strategy is? And, you know, kind of it must be that, or is it the actual is a cap, and for accounting you might, for some reason, and I can't think of why, want to do less. So I think it's a question of bringing out the extent to which your actual practices are the determination for the accounting. And so based on how you were nodding and shaking your head, I take it that what you had contemplated in this paper is that the proportion that you designate, the percentage that you designate, is the actual percentage, and we're just saying for accounting purposes, the model would accept having different proportion designated for growth versus for existing and future transactions.
But that also has to be as per your risk management.
Sorry?
That also has to be as per your risk management.
Yes. Yeah.
So you can't say that I have 100% of existing and reinvestments, mm-hmm, and 70% of growth, while your risk management is saying 100% for both.
Mm-hmm.
So it has to be consistent with what you're trying to achieve.
So it sounds then that we're going to have just a mechanical point we have to think about is, if there is an entity that for some reason has a different proportion for existing and future transactions, if we say those have to be the same, how we deal with... And I don't know if that's only a hypothetical or if it's something that could occur. Okay, so that was kind of the clarification point. The question to think about for future is, you know, you're making the point that it would be unusual and only in response to a specific event that there would be changes. Okay. But what if part of the dynamic risk management, and I'm making an assumption that this happens in practice, so is I'm in a 10% interest rate environment today, I expect interest rates to decline over the next 3 years. So my long-term dynamic risk management strategy is to, let's say, increase the proportion, you know, the percentage that I am actively managing, at least, you know, for the period of change to protect against the decline. Now, it's clear that I have documented here my economic expectations, therefore here's how I plan to respond with dynamic risk management, but that's, it's not like it's a specific event like 2008 where you say, okay, this resets all my expectation. Think about how we, you know, if it happens that people are looking forward and saying, here's how I plan to modify, how we incorporate that expectation into the model. I think that's maybe a specific instance of Daryl's range question, versus point question. I think we probably have to think through that. I'm not necessarily looking for anything today.
Yeah, I think we will definitely consider that. I would agree that that's probably best discussed during the target profile. So.
Okay. The challenge, we have done that, and we'll bring it in detail maybe absolutely in the target profile, but think of it, one of the things which we'll have to deal with, and it's already come up, is based on the anchor point. And as Ross always tells me, if you keep changing your risk management strategy every day, which is possible because of whatever, tell me when does it stop being an interest rate risk management strategy and when does it start becoming a trading strategy?
Right.
And that's what we will cover in the target profile, but it does interact with this.
Good job.
Thank you, Hans. I just have one further comment with regard to the sentence that Tab just mentioned of the paragraph 68.
Yeah.
It's when the changes to designated portfolios resulting from the update to the asset profile. If my understanding is correct, it's like a rebalance requirement, mm-hmm. which is set by the IFRS 9, similar. So I hope that there are some further discipline, because here it seems that in all cases, all those changes will be regarded as a continuation of the existing relationship. I think
will
that
be, Jinchou, because it's as per your plan. What other things?
I'm thinking that there are some imbalance which will result in some hedging effectiveness, whether this still can be considered as a continuation of the existing.
Okay, it's a start and stop question.
I think we need some criteria of, you know, disappearing, as IFRS 9 has some hedging ratio criteria, some other discipline to try to avoid that those hedging effectiveness could also be regarded as continuation of hedging relationship.
You're asking a very fundamental question, Jinchou, is when does the model stop? And is there a point at which you get thrown out of the model?
Yeah.
We'll come to it at the very end, because without seeing the performance and the whole model, we can't discuss that. But it's a very, very fundamental question.
We do plan to discuss it.
Absolutely.
Tom?
One, pull a fast one.
Yeah, I just have a question trying to tie a couple of things together. Just going back to Charles and Mary said, Charles, I think, indicated that risk management is going to be a bigger thing than, because of the paragraph 35 constraints,
this
management would be something larger. And Mary talked about, I think, a little bit about how much are you capturing by caught that. So when we talk about, I just want to make sure I understand this. So with respect to just the percentage of a portfolio,
yeah, I see where you're coming from.
You could think about the percentage of the portfolio just saying, well, this is the part we're going to do the risk, the interest rate risk management. But is there an interaction between this percentage of the portfolio partly get defined by some of the constraints in paragraph 35?
It will be, Tom. Absolutely. What you're talking about is what it not only gets constrained, it also has to be consistent with how they define their target profile. So one of the points which came up, which Martin mentioned, is that when we start putting things out and putting restrictions, it has to be also put the restrictions on the target profile. So yes, it will start get constrained.
And just coming back to what Francois said, Mary said, is so conceptually you could have a percentage where you were capturing everything in the whole risk management, but pragmatically because of the constraints, you're almost obviously working
within a smaller subset.
And if I understood what they were saying earlier, if the gap between the pragmatic and the theoretical gets too big, this will thing not. Probably wrecks.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, and that's where the outreach point comes in. We have to test that.
Thanks.
Okay. Question four on de-designation. Paragraph 75, staff have provided some preliminary views on events that would require de-designation of assets from the profile. And furthermore, the staff have provided a view that voluntary de-designation of assets should not be permitted unless there's a change in the risk management policies and procedures. That last part is consistent with IFRS 9. Found in paragraph 71 through 74.
Sue?
I agree with your criteria that you've got in paragraph 71, and also I would agree with being consistent with 9 and saying that if your risk management is continuing, you're stuck once you're in. But I wonder whether we need some more criteria. In particular, I think that if you fail other qualifying criteria, I would have thought you should be out as well. So, for example, you can have reclassifications of financial assets under 9, even though we hope that they're going to be rare. So if you're no longer eligible to be measured at amortized cost, presumably that would kick you out. And if a transaction is going to be highly probable, but you no longer think that it's going to be classified at amortized cost under 9, I think that would have to come out as well, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I would agree.
And are we intending that... So at the moment, in the qualifying criteria, we say if you've already designated a hedge accounting relationship, you can't get into the DRM model. Because you can't choose to just decide you don't want to be in the DRM model anymore if your risk management strategies stay the same, I presume that means you can't come out and go into the normal hedge accounting model as well.
You can't do that.
So you basically got to choose which of the hedge accounting models that you're in, and then once you, as long
you
as your risk management stays
the
same, you can't switch. Yeah. You can't cherry pick between the two.
Yeah, absolutely.
But we could have things that are managed on a portfolio basis, where somebody for some reason decides they want to use the standard hedge accounting model in mind.
But without
originally, so not switching.
Yeah.
Moving from existing state today to that, yes, they could move. That we'll have to consider in how you move into the model from existing hedge.
Martin.
And for me, it's difficult to agree to this and also to the next question, because I currently don't know the consequences, because I will explain. If we, for example, if credit risk becomes dominant and then we have to de-designate, what does it mean when we compare then the asset profile with the target profile, and what is the accounting consequences for that? And why I do saying that, because if a hedge account individual is breaking, that is kind of, the consequence is that you have to account for the underlying asset based on IFRS 9, and then maybe you have the derivatives on fair value, and you have to deal with that. But if you have a whole portfolio, and if you have to deal with the risk, if you're not qualifying for this hedge accounting, and let's assume also with documentation, an auditor will say, okay, your documentation is not up to date, and therefore you not qualify for this hedge accounting, and you have to done your whole banking book on that, and you have to deal with these accounting consequences, it could be the end of the bank, if you have to do different accounting and could not apply hedge accounting. And therefore, I think it is difficult to say, okay, what is the consequences of all of that without knowing how we deal with when a kind of is not any longer qualifying, if the target profile is not kind of what is be expected, and what is then the next step? Because that for me is very, very difficult, because if you can think about, you have then billions of derivatives in OCI, and then if you fail all the kind of requirements, then you have to bring that to P&L, that is the end of the bank, that can be the end of the bank. And therefore, I think to deal with this kind of all the stuff now without knowing how we deal with
performance
is difficult for me to answer. I generally agree in the direction, but
Martin, if the asset has gone away, I would be very surprised that we would say that.
For example, but if you said, for example, the second is also if credit risk is dominating, that could happen from one day to next, because you have assets which you have, and I don't know how you deal with that, and if you compare that with the target profile, because you have done your hedges already, and then your credit risk is dominating, what is then? And does it then break the whole kind of the model?
But we will have
this kind of questions. I don't have an answer currently, and therefore it is difficult for me to say, yes, I agree with this.
Okay.
Gary?
Thank you. And begin with a question about how risk portfolios are identified, then I'll go to my question. So if you have a complex bank, you know, would you have different risk profiles and targets if you got 20-year commercial real estate versus one-year consumer loans? They would be different portfolios approached differently in your risk management?
Maybe.
Maybe. Okay. It wasn't the answer I was expecting. No, but I'm trying to say they're very different asset durations, and 20-year risks different than a one-year risk.
So, yes, they're very different durations. They're different term risks. But if you're trying to manage just term interest rate risk, then what's the difference between 20 years and 1 year if that's really what you're managing?
Well, there's more risk with 19 extra years of things that could happen. Anyways, with that, the unexpected answer, I'll still ask my question. Make a comment here. Paragraph 75 now. This thing talks about de-designating of the portfolio.
Yep.
You could get the same result by, I'll just sell the underlying derivative too, right? Could you not? Do you view that as part of de-designating the portfolio?
I would like to talk about derivatives when we talk about derivatives, which is an unhelpful statement.
That's okay, but you understand the point. You can de-designate the portfolio, sell the portfolio, get rid of the derivative. Yeah. I mean, they all get to the same place, you know, through different things. Because everything's here focusing on the underlying asset portfolio and de-designation. Yep. There's different ways to get there. Yep. And the other thing that in some of the earlier comments here on the earlier one is, the question is, how far down can you subdivide portfolios? You say, fine, I can't de-designate it, and so on, so I'll just define it as a new portfolio, my commercial real estate risk. It's now different, you know, where I'm going to go is a different sector, you know, than the past. So for all of another portfolio, there are ways to get around it if you were inclined to do so. So I think that gets to be critical in defining the portfolio. The portfolio, the limits to it, you know, it doesn't change the strategy. It just changed the portfolio. You know, the strategy remains the same. So those are all these tactical nuts and bolts things that in time we'll have to deal with if not in the standard in the application guidance or something.
Anne? We've been talking about the risk management strategy and how important that is, and we're not expecting changes in it. As we went into question 3 and question 4, we started talking about objectives and about policies and procedures. So in your mind, is there a very clear relationship between strategy, objectives, and policy and procedures? Do these terms have very defined meanings within what we're doing here?
So I would say that the risk management, we could probably use the term risk management strategy, risk management objective interchangeably.
Mm-hmm.
Those should be documented very clearly within the entity's risk management policies and procedures, which should also address things of the nature as definition of portfolios, time horizons, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
So the policies and procedures I see is very different than objectives and strategies. However, the objective and strategy should be clearly documented in the policies and procedures.
Mm-hmm. So we can now read it as if we've got the word strategy or objectives is the same, and then policy and procedures is something else.
Let's keep that in mind. So, to go consistent.
And can I just follow up on Anne's? I was the chair there for a second. In 9, we already have this distinction between what sort of, I can't remember what the words are we use, but the sort of high-level strategy and then the lower-level whatever objectives. I can't remember which is which. But would the idea be that we'd try and use the consistent terminology and concepts if we can with 9?
Yes.
Because otherwise, that's how the voluntary de-designation works, and there's been a lot of discussion on that one. Yeah, maybe.
I'm Adam.
Thanks, Anshul. Okay. On these two questions, I have a similar reaction as Martin. It's hard to me to disagree with Martin with his objective reading of things. But my conclusion is the opposite.
Yeah.
It's interesting because Martin is already anticipating what is the practice, and the way I'm reading is how I would like to see the accounting model with some discipline around. So that's why I do agree with both questions, because I think it's important to me to have a view of what would be the ideal in the accounting standard, and then go and test. And that's why I think we agree on the basis, but the conclusion is distinct.
Mary?
On this point, after thinking about Martin's challenge, I guess, I tuned my planned yes to question four to be, what you're asking us for is, should you continue to develop the model on this basis? And, it moves from, I still say yes, but I think we have to assess the operational concerns that Martin raised about what are the consequences, and then maybe sooner rather than later come back and say, is this operational as a requirement, et cetera, and if not, what implications does it have for the discipline of the model? It isn't a decision, it's a, yep, this is the way you should continue to explore. The other question I had, and it goes back to, I think, a much more granular point about Sue's point about having made a determination, a designation decision about, let's say, DRM or existing hedge accounting model. You can't say once you wash out of DRM, okay, now let me see if I'm going to put it into the single model. And you said clearly no. It's a one-time choice. It's a one-time determination. We haven't talked about choice versus requirement. But think about whether the answer is the same for existing assets versus future transactions and growth, because what we're saying, you can incorporate future transactions and growth into your DRM, the actual initial recognition of the items that fall in the future transactions and growth is a later date. You're only kind of recognizing them for hedge accounting purposes here. I don't want an answer now. I just want to make sure we think through what that initial recognition means.
Sue?
Martin's comments are quite thought-provoking, but also I think something that's come up while we've been talking, some of us are talking about de-designation of assets and some of us are talking about de-designation of portfolios,
yep.
And to me they're two very different things. So I was thinking that what we were looking at here mainly, apart from if you've changed your risk management, when I think it is a portfolio type thing, but for the other stuff where you don't meet the qualifying criteria and all those things, I was thinking we were picking individual assets out.
Yep.
So I think one of the questions that's going to come from that would be what the performance consequences, which is what Martin's getting at, because say that you take one asset out, but it's a tiny asset in a big portfolio, should there be much of a consequence of that at all? But also I think there might be a question of if 70% of the portfolio suddenly doesn't qualify, what the heck does that mean for the portfolio overall? And I think that's something we need to think about. Also, just to build on Mary's very specific point about if you've been in DRM, you can't come into general hedge accounting, I think we need to be careful thinking through that. I agree there shouldn't be sort of too much cherry picking between the two. If you're in one, you're in one, and if your risk management stays the same, that should be the case. But let's say, for example, that you fall out of the DRM model because you're no longer SPPI or something like that, or you no longer qualify for amortized cost because there's been a change in business model.
Yep.
It might be an asset where you might want cash flow hedge accounting or something on it. There might be some reason why you might legitimately still want to do some risk management that would otherwise qualify for hedge accounting. So I think we need to be careful not being too strict. And that's going to be one of the tricky things of having two sort of side by side, slightly different models. The sort of gates around the two.
I agree, we'll have to think about that.
That's a good thing with that, but yes.
Yeah, I think to clarify at the outset that the support we give is the support for drafting something that's going to be subject to outreach. So I think we're going to learn from it and eventually have the possibility to adjust. So I remain supportive of your recommendations so far. To me, when I read the documentation requirements, they sounded to me what I would expect from internal control. And in fact, I would want to really very much rely on the internal control procedures in everything we look at from the documentation perspective. As little as possible is being done from purely an accounting perspective. I think the real difficult discussion that we're going to have around all these issues is when we discuss performance.
Yes.
Because probably in line with what just you said, I would not expect artificial circumstances to impact P&L, if I may say that way. So that, but I also expect that in the risk management practice, portfolios are defined and that they are managed consistently. So that's why, on that basis, I'm supportive.
Martin.
Only one additional thought, because when we, on the staff proposing that we don't allow this voluntary discontinuation of the, when would that mean for a kind of dynamic open portfolio that you never come out? And I think that is different regarding if we speaking about hedges in IFRS 9, which is in, because I think, therefore I am a little bit not absolutely sure if we should not allow it in any circumstances, because that would, for me, it would mean, okay, you have to do it forever, because you will never come out of that. And is that the right? I'm currently not sure at the moment, but it's only a thought which maybe staff should think a little bit about.
We are not saying you can never come out.
But what does it mean?
Voluntary means, basically, is that you can't flip things in and out to get an accounting result. If your risk management policies change, or you are doing a wind down of the portfolio, or you are wind down with those things will go down.
Only if you have an individual hedge, then it ends, because there is a term of that. Mm-hmm. But if you're doing as a kind of policy in your company, always do hedge accounting and dynamic for open portfolios, and if you don't allow, you have to follow this account.
Okay, I see what you're coming from.
Sorry. That is my point.
It will be based on the definition of your target profile. So if you have, let's say, a 15-year target profile, that's the period of the portfolio you have designated.
Yeah, but the next day is 15 years and one day. But
how open this is going to be? We'll come to that.
Is
yes.
that 15 years rolling in eternity? I still don't understand that.
That's what we will come back to. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. And the last one. The last one is around documentation. Our views are discussed in paragraph 76 through 77, but the documentation requirements are very much to be provide specificity around assets and portfolios, how they've been determined, how they're consistent with the risk management policies and procedures of the entities, and how the entity is meeting the assertion regarding highly probable if it is indeed having future transactions. So again, I think the point here, as I emphasize on my TF, is we would expect consistency in this documentation as per the risk management policies and procedures.
Okay. Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Discussion, good papers.